Welcome to The Leadership Mindset, the podcast where we uncover the hidden gems of sales and business leadership. And in each episode, our goal is to bring you up close and personal with the world's most accomplished business leaders. We explore their experiences, motivations, inspirations, and the challenges they've conquered on their way to the top. In today's episode, you can expect to learn about the transformative power of adaptability, cultural sensitivity, and the value of mentorship and professional growth. So grab a coffee and enjoy the conversation with today's guest, Kareem Hartvig. Kareem Hartvig, you're very welcome to the podcast. Kareem, tell me, I know you're German. Whereabouts in Germany did you grow up?
So I grew up in the southwest of Germany, close to Karlsruhe. Yeah. Not so far from the French border, and actually, yeah, in between city and countryside.
Okay, I've been to Karlsruhe once. That's not too far from Baden-Baden.
Yes,
in the Black Forest.
It is 20 kilometers, exactly.
Yeah, I spent a wonderful summer there back in 1985.
Ah.
I worked at Südwestfunk.
Okay,
yeah. I had their headquarters there. Yeah, I remember cycling down as well, down to the Rhine. Beautiful part of the country.
Indeed, yes.
What was it like growing up in that part of the world?
No.
I'm going to guess, what, in the 90s?
Yes, exactly. When you were there in 85, 3 months later, I also turned up. So yeah, it was nice growing up, actually. Yeah, I had best of both worlds. Like the city, a few trap stops away, but also and the countryside with all its advantages. It was actually nice growing up. I grew up as the oldest of four, which was also better than the other way around. Like I have a Moroccan mom, a German dad. I had very nice childhood, no complaint.
So tell me then what your childhood was like in terms of school. What did you enjoy in school? What did you want to be when you grew up?
Mm-hmm. So my dad is a primary school teacher, and like I actually enjoyed school very much. It was great to make friends, learn, do sports. What I wanted to grow up, pretty much the same as like all of my mates back then. We wanted to become professional football players, at least in the beginning. But yeah, that did not work out so well. Obviously, that changed later on. And I fought my way actually quite late. I tried a lot of different things. And actually, it all led towards a path to sales. I just didn't know it back then.
So what was it? Sometimes when I talk to people who are in sales, actually quite often, that when they look back at their childhood, there's clues there. Mm-hmm. There's something that they did, either as a hobby or or they worked with a parent who was in sales, or they had a stall, something. Was there anything in your background?
Yes or no. I was not the kid with the lemonade stand. That was not me. However, I always found it very easy to find a conversation with pretty much everyone. Was always a kind of curious kid, always wanted to understand what people do, why they do it, and to a degree that for some people was annoying. I really wanted to understand what drives people. I guess I was an all-rounder. Like when through school, I could do a lot, but I was not a specialist. Like my brother is a developer, like he knew this is where he wanted to go, and that's where he went. But I had an interest like in so many different things, and in my day-to-day job today, I think it's essential that I have a good understanding like of what people do, what companies do, what drives them. So thinking back, this was probably one of the clues that helped me know.
You mentioned that there was nothing special that you could point to in terms of said that was going to be in sales. I'm curious to know how you got there. I know you did an MBA in college. Was that part of the big plan? Or was there something else you had in mind? And like most of us, you ended up in sales by accident.
Yeah, I had a nice kind of a development towards sales. Like during my studies, I was working as a side job in SAP, and I was doing that in sales support. And that gave me one, exposure to tech and software, and B, to sales. And I had a good idea about what it was like, but later on still went towards more startups. And that is maybe something that was also a bit of a driver. Where I come from, right? Where I grew up in Karlsruhe, you've been there. Usually people of my age, when they graduate, they go to one of the big companies. There is like Siemens, BASF, Mercedes-Benz, and people go there and forget about what they initially set out to do, right? Usually graduating from school, people have like high dreams. They want to change the world. They want to do this. They want to do that. Then they go into one of those big corporations and that changes. And that was never for me. So I wanted to go into startup. I wrote my master thesis about startups. I was working in startups. And yeah, like a lot that I did there, saw there and learned there was like, there's two essential skills you need to have when building something great. Like one is an idea or like technical skills, and the other one is sales. And when I was working in those startups, especially in one where I was first working as a consultant on projects, and then later on, I noticed my natural kind of drive and where I see more my interests and my skills and the need of the business aligning was like selling these consulting service packages. And that's more or less when I told my manager back then, I was like, look, I enjoy working on those projects. I enjoy traveling and learning more about businesses of the different companies. But actually what I want to do and where I think I can add more value is like selling projects. And that's really when the shift, and to be honest, like a clarity came for me that I didn't have before. That's what I want to do.
I'm curious to know what your experience was like when you got into sales. A lot of people, certainly my experience was, I came from a pre-sales background. Sales always looked easy when you were looking at it from the outside. And then when you have to do it and you got targets to meet, it's very different. I'm wondering what your journey was like. Was there a point of realization, oh hell, what have I done here?
Yeah, pretty much. When I back then actually did the change, like I noticed that it was like much harder than expected. It was trial and error, but in the end, I noticed sometimes I didn't know when we won why we did win. And when we lost, sometimes we were wondering, okay, why did we lose? And that actually then led to my mentor recommending me, okay, if you really want to learn the craft, if you really want to learn the sales, or in particular the software sales, then you should learn it again from the ground up. And that's when I then changed to an SDR role and went to Dublin and learned a lot in those years, really from the very, very beginning, which still helps me to this day.
Did you feel in any way that was going backwards for you a little bit?
I had the conversation because some of my peers back then were like, so you are now in a end-to-end sales role. Why would you go to an SDR role? And to be honest, if I hadn't had this kind of a mentor who was really like, this might look like a step back, this might for other people look like not the right thing to do, but it will pay off in the long run, I probably would not have done it. And to be honest, it was the right thing to do. And yeah, like it was more like trusting this mentor than anything else back then.
There's a few things I'm hearing in that, Kareem. One is the importance of a good mentor, firstly.
Yep.
Secondly, and I've only heard this from a few people, and I think I wanted to just stop and focus for a moment because I think this will encourage people who are maybe at a crossroads, not quite sure what to do, and may feel that taking an SDR or a BDR type role is somehow or another going backwards. And it was the first person I saw did that, and I had her on the podcast, and she's the general manager of EMEA. So very senior individual. And she was working in very high pressure, very successful career. And she wanted to make the transition into technology sales. And the only way for her to do it was to take an entry level job at a technology company. And now look where she is. And so you did the SDR in Dublin. Did I miss you then?
I had a training with Marcus.
Ah, yes. I remember that class. And I was in it, I think. I brought him in because I thought I was going to miss it. I was coming back from Prague and there was a high risk. So I got Marcus to come over. Yeah. I remember that class.
I remember the whip. It's still, I see the picture. Yeah.
I got one of those as well. I got in trouble with it. So I haven't used it anymore. But Lordy me. Very good. Talk to me a little bit about the people in your life who have inspired you.
Yeah, maybe starting with that mentor. I used to work with her in SAP, and she clearly told me, you will not regret making this move. And she also told me, if you really want to stand out in here in Germany, I recommend you go like to a US company, because how they do sales is different how we do it here. And you will benefit from that even more than if you would do this in SAP kilometers from your hometown. And all of that was correct. And I'm still very thankful for this recommendation. And then there's a lot of other people that inspired me one way or another. Like one, obviously my dad, who to this day still is always trying to make the right thing and leaving the planet better than when he entered it. It's like, it's great inspiration also now that he's retired. Like, he's still doing a lot of good work on the social side. So yeah, that's, yeah, another source of inspiration for me.
And what is it that you do that gives you a great sense of satisfaction and accomplishment?
A few things maybe combined. Obviously in sales, it's about numbers, right? We want to reach our targets. We want to do well. But one thing, what's important for me is while doing that or while doing so, not creating enemies, or at least not too many, right? While I'm still to a certain degree climbing up the ladder, I want to stay on the positive side when the elevator goes down, that there's not a burned land. And on the other hand side, like I never ask like anything from my team that I wouldn't do myself. I always want to make sure I can justify what I ask them to do also in front of myself. I want to be successful, but not at any cost. So I try to balance those goals. And so far, I think it's been okay. That's how I want to keep it actually for the future also.
And looking through some of the recommendations people have written for you on LinkedIn, that's very clear. That's important to you and you've succeeded in it. People speak very highly of you.
Yeah.
It is, which is always good because you're right. You got that. You never know who you meet on that ladder who's climbing faster, or when you start to maybe later on who you're going to meet on the way up.
Exactly.
And so what I'm really curious about, Kareem, is that transition from IC to leadership. What was that like in terms of what were your expectations and what was your reality?
I think I had a fair idea. I had been in a kind of lead role in my free time in sports. Like, I always wanted to lead to a certain degree, and I did lead in different capacities. So my expectation was in that role, or then in work in general, was, yeah, I had a fair idea. And it was like a transition that before I was like the team lead, and then it happened very fast because I wasn't the first in line for that job, but the two external candidates just didn't get through. It was like, what's with this guy? Can he do it? Let's give him a try. And that happened fast. The kind of biggest challenge was then from being a peer, then actually managing the team that I was in before, to first make sure that I don't jump in and do the work myself, but then also making sure that like the team members understood, like, now, like, not their peer anymore. They report to me without damaging the relationship. I never wanted to just be seen as, okay, he's the manager, and because of his role, we have to do this, we have to do that. I always wanted to make sure it's understood, okay, I'm here to help, right? I'm not here to only ask for things. Like, we're both in the same boat. We want to be successful. And I wanted to be seen and understood as, like, the leader because of competence, know-how, and not because of my role. And yeah, there was a challenge in the beginning, but I think it actually worked out quite well.
That's not easy to do, particularly if you're managing a team that you are working with.
Yeah.
That's a really difficult line to thread. And then also you mentioned, which is another issue that comes up a lot, is the idea of doing it yourself because you're used to doing it. And sometimes that's the fastest way to do it short term.
Yes.
But not the best way, obviously, to do it long term. Any bumps in that road along the way? Anything you could look back and go, either I wish I did that differently, or it's a lesson I learned the hard way?
Yeah. A couple, right? So the keeping the hands off was a challenge in the beginning. And to be honest, I knew that. And in the beginning, I even used to say, I'm still more sales than sales manager, especially when you have done exactly that particular role. Then you're always tempted to say, hey, just wait here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, or take the lead in a conversation or whatever. So that was definitely the biggest challenge, especially when, like, different cultures, if you think about Hofstede, like the cultural dimensions, like some cultures, like, you can be very direct, and others, it's frowned upon and you get in trouble if you're too direct.
How did your international experience help you with that role?
That helped. What I just referred to with the cultural dimensions, I've been in Asia, I've been in Europe in different countries. Like, half of my family is from a complete different cultural background. So I have an idea that working with people from different backgrounds, you need to understand, or you should at least take into account where people are coming from and where their values are, how they communicate, if they're like high context, low context, if they have like high power distance, low power distance. Like, I try to remind myself sometimes about this and make sure maybe be a bit more careful here. Or when I was living in the Netherlands, I could not be too direct, because they were even more direct. That helped me quite a bit, yeah. With regards to the power distance, it's even in the language. So in the Anglo world or in Ireland, you have you, one way to approach someone. In Germany or in France, you have a formal and an informal way. So it's even manifested in language, but there's differences in people and how you can talk to them.
What's fascinating to me about that as well is when you take people out of their culture, they behave very differently.
Exactly.
They're not bound by the cultural norms of where they've come from. I don't know, did you ever read that book, Malcolm Gladwell? Oh, I can't think of the name of it now, but he talked about this. It was Korean Airlines back in the 70s. There was a number of crashes with Korean Airlines. So many crashes that the countries would not allow Korean Airlines to fly over their airspace.
Okay.
And they did this investigation, and what they discovered was that they're the captain on the aircraft is considered like godlike.
Yeah.
And that the co-pilot, same skill set essentially from a flying perspective, but really is there to carry the bag for the captain. And you did not question the captain. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting was the captain wasn't paying attention, and the co-pilot could see the plane was flying towards a mountain.
And he wouldn't.
But could not be direct with him, could not say, "Oi, listen, we're in trouble here, wake up. They had to, in some sort of indirect way, and that resulted in several crashes. But the interesting thing was when they took the co-pilots for retraining, and when they were outside of their own culture, they had no difficulty speaking to authority.
Yeah.
Now you're in Okta. How do you find the differences between your startup and the corporate culture?
In terms of speaking up or power distance, or you can really light it up that way, like startup, Okta, Oracle, right? So that's the bandwidth. So in a startup, it's your friends with pretty much everyone, because you spend most of your life with these people, and it's only a few of them. It's also not the kind of healthiest way, I would say, because in a way, work should still be work, and everything else should still be everything else. And a startup is just one big blur. And in terms of Okta, is in a way a healthy mix, like still not forgetting the roots, and that this is a company that's not so old and not so big, but also now big enough to still have some kind of attributes of bigger companies that you wouldn't see in startups. And then obviously Oracle is a giant tanker where I first, you know, firsthand learned how to deal with politics, how to deal with the fact that you're really a number somewhere down the line, and there's not much you can do, not much you can shape, which then also led me to, I want to go somewhere where I can have a higher degree of influence and where I can still stay true to myself while climbing up the ladder.
If you weren't doing what you're doing currently, what would you like to be doing?
There's maybe two things. I'm still interested in startups, right? I do help some startups from my network to how they build a Salesforce, and have a couple of people there in my network where I do some coaching. So one day, either founding something myself or joining really from the beginning would be something that I always wanted to do, and which might happen. And then aside from that, what I mentioned earlier, my dad is working a lot in the social space. Like, he's doing work with refugees. He's doing work with environment, sustainability action. So that is also something I would probably be doing if I wouldn't be in sales.
I saw something about Nablus on your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
That was actually an adventure that was not really planned. I had a friend, and she was working there for an NGO in the West Bank of Palestine. And when I was growing up, I'd helped my dad in afternoon school playing football with the kids or having German class when I could. When it worked out, I just helped him because his school was right next to mine. And when my friend was down there teaching for this Project Hope NGO, it's really their idea was like change through education. They have a couple of locations around the world where they just try to teach, educate kids with the idea and the hope that over time there will be change. So I was very interested in getting involved. And luckily my manager back then in Dublin was very supportive of this. She said, yeah, this is impossible due to the regulations that we have. You cannot work from the West Bank, and like there's no kind of unpaid leave or whatever. But then we just had an agreement, like if I would reach my targets, like the quarter before, and I could use all of my holidays, she would ignore that my chair in the office was empty for 6 weeks if the work would still be done. And it was fantastic. I traveled down there. I could make a lot of very new, very also lasting experiences, and didn't even have to quit my job for doing that, because I came back there and I could just continue the work I did before.
In what ways did that experience change you?
In like a lot of ways, right? A couple of things that I saw there really put stuff in perspective. How people live in the refugee camps where we were teaching. But then also I saw two people getting shot at the doorstep of my house. And if you see this, and that's what I sometimes tell some of my refs when they're just heartbroken because of a bad quarter. There is worse things in this world than missing a number. And that's probably most of the lasting experiences. And also it, to a big degree, changed also my worldview on some of the challenges that we have in this world, be it religion, be it politics. It was very forming, although it was not a long time, but it was an intense time.
I think it's interesting that for people who haven't had that can often see something trivial. I think they give us perspective skills, which sometimes I think you have to experience. It's not a lesson you can read or go into a class and learn about. I think it's a life experience that you have to have. Is there anything like that in your future, do you think? If you had 10 million in the bank in the morning, would you go startup, or would you do something different, or would you do startup then something different?
Maybe both. There's a lot of startups that try to combine their goals of building and growing a company. Probably both.
Tell me, what do you like to do to relax when you're not working or thinking about work?
Spending time with the family. Like we have a toddler who's keeping us busy. That's at the moment, I wouldn't call it winding down, but he's keeping us busy. Other than that, like football a lot, cycling more and more now that my football times seem to be coming to an end. Like really enjoy cycling on a weekly basis, just to go out and work out, get the head free, and like also like at least once a year go to multi-day trips to really get out of the city into the nature and just forget about everything in a way.
If you were Minister for Education and you could make anything mandatory on the school curriculum, what would it be and why?
Probably financial education. We learn pretty much everything in school, but we don't learn how to build savings, how to do tax, how to invest, like how money actually works. That is something I would probably make mandatory for a year or two, just to give young people growing up, who are not growing up in a family where money is there, or the idea of how to get money, how to earn money, how to keep money, is like something that's natural and they have the network and the knowledge, also have a chance to understand, how do I make money? How do I keep money? How do I invest money? That is really something I think should change, because I see it now where like I have two younger sisters, like not there, like it's not being taught anywhere. So yeah, that is something I would probably get in the curriculum.
I'm hearing, Karim, about an individual who had an interesting formative experience, some really interesting life-changing life experiences, quite an interesting trajectory from a work perspective. Particularly the bit that struck me most was SDR role and going to Dublin for that. And you're ambitious, I can tell that. But also it's ambition with guardrails. It's not ambition at any price. So I'm getting this image of somebody who's very rounded, a really nice person to be with, somebody who's caring. Tell me something about yourself that you reckon nobody at work knows about you.
Oh, okay. I got kicked out of secondary school at the age of 14. So I guess that is not really well known. Back in the days, we had a school system of three different secondary schools, right? So one is like for the kind of kids who did well in the primary school, or very well. Then there's like the kind of medium segment, and then there's like the ones who didn't do so well. And I was in the gymnasium, and my teenage years were like challenging, and I was challenging a lot, and that didn't work so well there. And then I was kicked out from that school, and these other schools, they don't have to take you, right? Only the bottom one really has to take you. So I was kicked out from school, and then with my dad, who obviously knew all the people from the different schools, I had to go from school to school and see who would take me. And I guess like no one at work really knows that.
That must have been a difficult conversation with your father, he being a teacher.
Yeah, but we had a lot of difficult conversations in that time.
Do you mind me asking you, what were you pushing against that caused this period in your life?
To be honest, I'm still one. So that there's two things maybe to this. One thing is I had a lot of energy, right? So when I was a kid in school, like one of the school doctors said, he's hyperactive, right? And to be honest, to a certain degree, this kind of energy level helps me today. It helps me a lot, right? And the other thing was, I didn't really know how and what. There was no clear North Star back then. And I was troubled in a way. And the only one actually who really said he's going to be fine at the other end was my dad. Like, we had difficult conversations. But for example, when there's like this kind of hyperactive statement, he said, yeah, he has a lot of energy. Like, he's going to be okay. No need to make this more than what it is.
Have you ever been diagnosed with ADHD?
Nope.
Really interesting, because that's something I've been reading up on an awful lot recently. But when I read it and you hear other people's stories, there's lots of common threads. And one of them, they're known as the energetic ones.
Yeah.
But a lot of them get in trouble as well because they struggle to stay on task with attention. They're always moving. And of course, in an environment, like in school environment, where your job is to sit down, shut up and listen.
Mm.
It's really difficult. In fact, it's impossible. If that's the way you're wired, it's impossible. And therefore, it's easy to get in trouble because teachers don't like it. And of course, as you're a teenager, there's a natural rebellious spirit in many of us anyway.
Yeah.
And you combine those together, it's quite a potent mix. And a lot of kids back before these things were understood got in trouble a lot. And then often, if I would imagine, you're very lucky in a way to have your father, who probably understood it intuitively, being a teacher, probably saw this in others, and then saw that, you know what, they were okay eventually. They were able to harness that energy.
Exactly.
But people who don't have those supports can end up in jail because they get into all sorts of trouble because they feel like they're outside of everybody else. They don't feel like they're part of it necessarily. It's quite an interesting one.
That's why I say, like, a lot of people don't know or could not imagine. Like, I was wild back then.
How would you describe your friends back then?
Honestly, most of my friends from back then are still my friends now, like only 600 kilometers away. But yeah, it's teenagers, right? Like, it's not... I cannot blame bad company or whatever.
I was going with the opposite on this one, Kareem, because I have a theory that I think it's more than a theory, perhaps, is that when we get to a certain age as a teenager, our parents have very limited influence over us, that it's our friends. And if we have good friends, that can make a huge difference in our lives. And clearly, if they're still your friends, they're good friends.
Yeah.
I only say that for other people who are parents who are thinking about their kids and worrying about them, is look at their friends. If they've got good friends, they'll be fine.
Exactly.
They'll be absolutely fine. A couple of quick questions just to finish this out. I have three questions I wanted to ask you. One is, I want to play Desert Island with you. So Desert Island, meaning that you're going to be marooned on a desert island. You don't know if you're ever going to be rescued. What one item would you take?
Maybe I would take some grapes and then I grow some wine there.
That's the most unique answer I've ever had to that. Most people say it's something to entertain themselves, like a guitar or something like they can build a boat, whatever it is. But I've never had anybody say get some grapes and grow some wine.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Very good. If you were to write a book on any subject, what would you like to write it about?
One thing that I will actually probably rewrite if I ever find the time. In my master thesis, I wrote about startups and relating the early days, years, and how they financed in the beginning to actual outcome. And I recently came across it and I don't like it anymore. So one day I'll probably, if I have another half a year to spend, I will do that again. Yeah, probably that would be the first thing that comes to mind.
So another final question, although it has probably two parts to it. I want you to imagine your home is burning down.
Mm-hmm.
Your family, you're safe. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. Family, you're safe. I don't know if you have any pets, but they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And your computer and your phone, they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And you have time to run back in and rescue one item. What would it be?
At the moment, probably diapers. That would be of the essence. But honestly, like, I don't have a lot of physical stuff. I would not run back in.
Okay, very good. Apart from the diapers, that's, again, another unique answer I've never had.
Yeah.
And then final question is, if there's a book written about your life, what would you like the title of it to be?
Maybe like something, I don't know, a good man that used his second chance. I don't know, maybe something like this, yeah?
Second chances? I like that, yeah. Why second chance? What was that about?
What I referred to earlier with the kind of kicked out of school.
Gotcha.
Because that's, like, there was like a couple of other kids left and right, like it didn't go so well for them.
Very good. Kareem Hartwig, thank you so much for being my guest on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Paul. Really enjoyed it.